really appreciate being asked to speak to you folks, because one of the things that the Grey Panthers has embodied from the very beginning is the notion of continuance, and of continuing through whatever circumstances we may find. And I think that that's a tremendously essential quality in the current time.
Could you get closer to the mic? I'm having trouble hearing you.
I find that that's a tremendously essential quality in the current time, which is the notion of perseverance. And so I think that this organization has a lot of lessons and the people in it for the rest of us and for how we're going to be able to keep on. I was thinking there was a phrase from Bertolt Brecht, "He who laughs has not heard the terrible news." And I thought, well, most of us have heard the terrible news. And how do we act in the midst of the terrible news of our time? You know, terrible news that may continue for a while, for a good long time. How do we act and not only keep on acting, but do it in a way that doesn't leave us downhearted and brittle and simply going through the motions, because that doesn't work. So somehow we need to be able to come up with the resources in ourselves and to inspire others to be able to take a stand. And one of the things I did in creating The Impossible Will Take a Little While is try to draw together lessons and stories and voices in some sense globally that would be able to give us a sense of context and a sense of hope. And hope is a little of a slippery commodity. It doesn't necessarily mean that we know how things are going to turn out or that we know that they're going to turn out for the better. We don't. We really can't promise that. But it does mean that we can have a kind of, Vlachov Havel calls it, an orientation of the heart that drives us towards working for justice and allows us to believe, in the words of the wonderful minister Jim Wallace of Sojourners, that hope, says hope is believing in spite of the evidence and then watching the evidence change. And I believe in some sense it's going to be those leaps of faith that are essential to act in this current time. Now, when I look at history, I always see the unexpected turnings and the ways in which, at a point that something is just seems absolutely bleak, you never know. I remember years ago a friend of mine was visiting Berkeley, and this was 1963. He was traveling, working with the SDS in its earliest incarnation, and said, sort of reported back and said, you know, this is just the deadest campus. Nothing is ever going to happen here. It just, you know, I mean, they're just, you know, I mean, there's some people, they're trying. I mean, but my God, look at everything they're up against. It's just, you know, nothing's going to happen. And, you know, I think it was 6 weeks later, the free speech movement breaks out. And so, you know, you don't know. You get surprised by history again and again and again. And so part of the temptation in the wake of the past election is to really, how to describe it? Well, it's to do one of two things, both of which are dangerous. One is obviously to deny the consequence and the gravity. I mean, there's an extremely ruthless group of people who are bent on gathering as much power as they possibly can, and democracy is not on their agenda, and caring for the planet is not on their agenda, and having any kind of possible compassion for those who get creamed by their policy is not on their agenda, and that's very real. On the other hand, I think it's all very tempting in a way that Tony Kushner says, calls it despair is a lie that we're telling ourselves. And it's very tempting to project the future in the kind of model of an unending present with the bleakest moments continuing to play out. And I think that that's an equal trap. So it doesn't mean in any way ignoring what goes on. But as we look at it, being able to say, all right, where still is the potential for change? How do we manage to reach out? How do we manage to move forward? And I was thinking, I often talk about the Rosa Parks story as a kind of microcosm, because it's what we don't know about social movements in America. And it came to me, I was being interviewed on a CNN show, and Parks was on the show by telephone, and I was all excited. And they said, one day Rosa Parks refused to move to the back of the bus, and that started the civil rights movement. And I got very upset, because if you know the real story, Parks at that point had been a civil rights activist for 12 years. She was the secretary of the NAACP local. And what they ended up doing, which is really the story that comes out, one of the few stories that most people know about social change, is it making it sound as if it was a kind of lone individual acting in isolation, acting almost on a whim. I remember Garrison Keillor, who I really appreciate for the kind of increased political engagement of late, but he was well-meaningly on Martin Luther King Day at one point saying, Rosa Parks wasn't an activist, she was just a woman with her groceries who was tired. And I thought, well, no, she took trainings at Highlander Center. She was an activist. She was somebody who deliberately worked for change. It didn't come out of nowhere. And so what they stripped away in that story is they stripped away the community, the intentionality, and the persistence, all of which are just critical to being able to make change. Because if you don't have them, you're not going to be able to keep on. And you don't have the NBC cameras zooming in to say Rosa Parks is making history, she's taking minutes at a meeting. But in fact, you know, that though it's those small building blocks that change history as well as the grand stage actions. And so one of the lessons is that we need to be able to have that kind of long-term perseverance and that intentionality. But that intentionality is coupled with a leap of faith. So it means you lose an election, you look and you say, okay, what didn't we do? What could be done differently? Who do we need to reach out to? Who do we need to bring in? All those kinds of critical questions. But you also end up needing to have that leap that says, we don't know at what point this will turn, but it will only turn through our actions. That is the sense of history as contingent. And that, to me, I mean, it's a core theme of all the voices that I found globally in The Impossible. It'll take a little while. That's a core theme because, again and again, what I've come up against is the sense that history turns unexpectedly. The other thing that I think is really critical is to recognize that when we're trying to work for change, we're doing two things. One is we are trying to address an immediate challenge, stop a war, win an election, create an environmental fight, save the remnants of our social support system from the kind of predatory activities of the Bush administration. We're also doing something else, which is equally important, which is we're trying to broaden the base. And that came to me in this amazing essay Vaclav Havel that wrote a piece in 1986, that is, before 3 years before Czechoslovakia got its freedom, 3 years before the Berlin Wall falls. And he was describing the growth of their social justice movement and their democracy movement in Czechoslovakia. And it's interesting because he actually traced it back to, of all things, a rock band, a group called the Plastic People of the Universe that was influenced by American rock musicians like Frank Zappa and the Velvet Underground and some other groups. And the authorities didn't like them, and they called their music morbid and not socially constructive, which kind of reminded me of George Bush and the Dixie Chicks. That is to say that socially constructive music is sort of in the eye of the beholder, and if you're challenging a regime, they naturally didn't feel it was very socially constructive. And the musicians obviously did, so their authorities harassed them, and they pulled their musicians' union's card so that they couldn't make a living off of their music. And they broke up their concerts when they played anyway for free. And they eventually started throwing them in jail, at which point Havel was a little bit older and more respectable, formed a defense committee, and that unexpectedly evolved into Charter 77. That was the pivotal human rights group in Czechoslovakia. Now, what's interesting about that is that, again, you wouldn't think that starting out trying to defend the rights and free expression of a rock band would leap to this democracy movement. But in fact, I think that's often how things often occur with history, where they take unexpected turnings, but only with those kinds of actions of courage being part. Nelson Mandela calls it the multiplication of courage. And my sense is that in a time where we're told we're disloyal merely for questioning any policy of this administration, and that's likely to only increase in the coming years of this term, we need that multiplication of courage. And we need to remember that at some point, if you draw the line in one situation, it may in fact leap unexpectedly. And oftentimes, you know, out of very, very bleak situations is where social change occurs. I mean, you go back to Parks, and her first involvement was around the issue of lynching. I mean, a very, very dark chapter in our history. And I remember being in the Civil Rights Museum in Memphis where Dr. King was killed, the former Lorraine Motel, and seeing a picture of some very well-dressed men and women in their sort of Sunday clothes standing around, kind of laughing, smirking. It was kind of a George Bush-type smirk at a, you know, at a, as if at a picnic. But in the background, a black man was burning to death. I mean, and that was what was that was what people like Parks were taking on. And so what that suggests to me is that sometimes out of taking on just, you know, the hardest possible situations, if you take them on with enough courage, something can turn. Again, one of the lessons. Now, in Havel's case, another lesson, again, is the bringing forth and the broadening of the base. And at one point, they were circulating a petition to free some political prisoners. And they were getting just absolutely condescended to in the most cynical terms, even by people who supposedly were on the same side, like the Czech novelist Milan Kundera was in exile in Paris at that point. And I remember Kundera writing it. He refused to sign the petition, and through one of his books he said the people speaking out for the political prisoners were being exhibitionistic and indulgent and were just trying to get attention, and they should maybe quietly help behind the scenes if they wanted to do something, but this was not going to really change anything. And Havel, writing about 7 or 8 years later, said something interesting. He said, you know, we actually didn't free any political prisoners. I mean, we tried and we failed, and sometimes you just don't succeed. He said, but when those people got out of jail, they told us that it was our efforts that allowed them to keep on going. And that without it, they would have just felt so isolated and so alone, they probably would have given up. So that allowed them to keep on challenging this unjust regime. He said, you know, not only that, but all those people who came in to sign that petition, they didn't stop there. They went on to write dissident plays and play dissident music and preach dissident sermons in the pulpits and teach differently in the classrooms and on and on and on and on. And he said, you know, that was a movement that now had the power to begin bringing down that regime. And in fact, of course, it did. And so, again, when I think of this, I think of a friend of mine, the African-American civil rights historian and theologian, Vincent Harding, who used the phrase, there's a river, talking about a river of social justice involvement. And he's a theologian, so he traces it back to the biblical prophets and forward into the future, and essentially says that all of us are part of a stream. I mean, Maggie Kuhn, you know, the founder of this organization, the Grey Panthers, is part of that stream. Everybody who's worked for social justice is part of that stream. And the reason I like that concept is that it reminds us that we're not alone. Because one of the things that any culture, whether it be Havel's Czechoslovakia or George Bush's United States, will try and do, any repressive regime, is to convince us that we're alone, convince us that we're isolated. I mean, remember the polls right after the Iraq War's first phase, where, you know, with people, they're saying, well, you know, 90% of the population, 85, just think this is a wonderful thing because mission is accomplished and the bombs have fallen on Baghdad and everything's fine. And it was really an attempt to isolate people. And I would argue that, I mean, unfortunately, public sentiment didn't quite shift enough to carry the election, but it was pretty split, on the verge of it. And I would argue the reason was part, obviously, the morass that the regime got bogged down in, but it was also all those courageous voices of all of us who, in fact, continued speaking out even when we were told that it would do no good and that nobody would listen and that the entire country was lined up behind Bush. And that's only how things change. I remember talking with Mary Robinson, was the former UN High Commissioner for Human Rights and President of Ireland, and asking her, she'd been essentially forced out of her job by the Bush administration. And I said, well, how do you deal with that kind of bullying? How do you stand up? And she said, well, people just have to stand up and take the cost, because only then does it change. If enough people stand up, it changes. But it doesn't change through silence, because silence feeds on itself. And courage, I believe, is contagious. And we're going to need those examples of courage. And so we saw that in Havel's Czechoslovakia, where people just made the choice to stand up to the regime, even though if you asked any observer from the outside, they would have said they had absolutely no chance of prevailing, that the regime is going to continue for 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years further. And yet they had that faith to, again, be able to see over the horizon part of what's essential. Now, in thinking about that, I think a lot about the people who came in during, say, that anti-war movement, and then followed in efforts like the Dean and Kucinich campaigns, and then even for all the very, very mixed feelings about Kerry, which many of which I think were borne out. I mean, I think the sense that, you know, had he just said when they asked that question about would he still support the invasion, and he gave that idiot answer that said yes, he would, if he had just said, I was lied to, and, you know, I was lied to, and we don't deserve to be lied to, I think he might be president to this day. I mean, that was what they had. You know, Karl Rove called it the gift that keeps on giving. And he was accurate. I think that was what they hung him on for the flip-flops. So when people were working for him, myself included, we were doing it pretty clear-eyed, not with many illusions, but with a sense that this was an exceedingly dangerous administration that we wanted to get out. And it's understandable to feel defeated, because on some level we lost. But I also think there's another way of looking at it, which is, if you look at all those people who came in the past year or two of involvement, I mean, there are 3 or 4 million people who've come in to social justice involvement and peace involvement. And if, and it's an if, it's not guaranteed, if we can convince them to be able to stay in it for the duration of the journey, which means the duration of their lives, we do have the most powerful base for social justice that we've had in many decades. And we shouldn't underestimate the power of it. It doesn't mean that we should be complacent. It doesn't mean that we have huge amounts of work to do expanding beyond that base. But it is a base to work with that we did not have 3 or 4 years ago. And so what, in a sense, what we've done, when Harding talks about there is a river, we've broadened that river of social justice involvement. And that can be very powerful for the future. And so if we think, and there's a temptation, obviously, to say, well, my efforts were in vain, they didn't matter, they didn't succeed, I think we have to be a little careful before reading the final verdict of history on the efforts that we made. I mean, this is the core theme of The Impossible. Will take a little while, is that you don't know how history is going to turn. And yet, when you bring people in to be able to take a stand and teach them how to persevere, which means, of course, giving the lessons that we've learned over our own lifetimes as activists, that very powerful things can happen. And that's something that most people aren't taught by our culture, because this is a culture of instant results. And it's, you know, it's the MTV blink of an eye ad. And if we actually learn to try and think in terms of long-term change, that's a challenging thing to do. I think it's a challenge for everybody. It's particularly for those who are just getting involved, particularly those younger. Tremendous challenge. Because if you've lived long enough, you end up seeing change. But if you're just starting out, where does it come from? It's hard to be able to look through on over the horizon. It's hard to be able to look beyond just the given culture, and yet we have to be able to do that. It's essential. And there's a number of ways that we, I think, persist to be able to do that. One is a sense of community. I mean, I mentioned that in terms of the people in jail and hovel, is Czechoslovakia. Nelson Mandela has an amazing essay where he talks about the Robben Island years. And you have to imagine him going to that island prison and being told, Mandela, you will never leave here alive. And the first few years you think, well, of course, I'm going to get off this island and the political winds will change and somebody will pressure the administration and I'll get out. 3 years, 5 years, 10 years goes by, 15 years, 20 years, 25 years. By about the 25th year, it's starting to get a little bit better. You know, and I know the 27th year he gets out and, as we know, becomes president of South Africa. But how do you sustain involvement for 27 years in a South African jail? And what I found, and this is the essay I use in The Impossible, will take a little while, is that he and the others, because it wasn't just him, it was a whole community there, they maintain it by two things: continuing to resist and continuing to build that community. So, for example, they were denied newspapers as a way of isolating them. And a guard would discard his sandwich wrapper, that would be a newspaper, and they would look at it, and they would smuggle it under their shirts, and they would copy it down on a tiny piece of toilet paper and the summary of the story or the headline, and pass it cell to cell to cell. And it was a way of reminding people that they weren't alone, that there was this larger world out there, that even within the prison there was a community, where they would be breaking rocks in the yard and they would start whistling a freedom song. And I think that's part of that spirit that we have to be able to have, which is, again, not to isolate ourselves in our communities, because one of the tremendous challenges of this time is to reach out to those folks who believed that George Bush is making this country freer or safer or, God help us, more just, or you know, those are folks that are good folks. I think it's a real challenge in our legitimate anger and fury at what's being done by the lies of the people running this country to not take it out on the people who've believed their lies because they happened to tune to the wrong TV channel and somehow got stuck there, or the wrong radio station, or in that loop of Fox and Rush, and or a preacher who somehow says that the deindustrialization of this country and the bankruptcy of family farms are because somebody gets married in San Francisco who happens to be of the same sex. I mean, that, you know, or that. I mean, I didn't believe until I got an email from somebody. I have a large email list. If you go to the impossible.org, there's a website where people can sign up. And somebody said, well, they're going to make a law that if you preach against homosexuality, you'll be thrown in jail. And I just thought, where is this coming from? I said, I don't think so, but it's something that Focus on the Family and some other groups were sending out, and some people believed that lie and voted in some ways to help destroy their own communities. I mean, a very damaging process. And so when I talk about the value of community in keeping us going, the counter side is having the courage to be able to reach out beyond our community, to reach out to some of those others. And it's interesting, my closest friend, I wrote about him in an earlier book of mine, Soul of a Citizen, is an environmental activist and commercial fisherman. And at one point, they were trying to... They'd been so effective in making the fishermen a voice for the environment on things like habitat and watershed protection that some of the big industrial interests tried to knock them out with this initiative in my state of Washington here. And my friend brought together this coalition that included the fishermen, of course, and the environmental groups. But it also included some of the fishermen were members of very conservative churches like Assembly of God. And they actually ended up getting an Assembly of God preacher giving an invocation against corporate greed on the steps of my state capitol and sending out a letter to every Assembly of God church in the state. And so when they finally beat back this initiative, I mean, they were tremendously outspent and outgunned, but did it anyway. And I remember seeing them celebrate, and you had the fishermen, and you had people from Friends of the Earth, and you had some of the Native American tribes that they brought in on it, and you had people from some of these fundamentalist churches. I remember one of them, and they were, I guess, a TV station had said something in support of this initiative, and one of the people who was one of the fishermen said, well, you know, Jesus was a fisherman, and when he comes back, he's going to rip your head off. And you can't do this. You can't knock out family fishermen. And I think the reminder to me, I asked my friend recently, you know, how those folks were going to be voting, you know, those fishermen who are part of those congregations, how they were going to be voting in this election. And he said, well, it's interesting. We've done enough work now. We've got enough of a cohesive community, and it's clear enough to them that these large industrial interests are what's destroying their livelihood that they're not going to vote for George Bush. But you need that kind of moral solidarity. It's the same way as there was a survey after 2000. I'm a member of the National Writers Union that's part of United Auto Workers, and the UAW did a survey in Michigan, where obviously a lot of their base is, and found that, as elsewhere, gun owners in general went for George Bush, as they did all over the country, one of these not sort of manufactured non-issues. Union gun owners went solidly for Al Gore, and I suspect if they did a similar survey this time, would have gone, you know, went solidly for Kerry as well. Why? Because that sense of social solidarity and that other vision trumped those manufactured divisive issues. And so part of the challenge is to reach out beyond our communities, but at the same time, to be able to build on them to keep us going, because the culture will try and isolate us. I think we also need imagination in its most radical sense, which means looking beyond the bounds of the given. We're always told that there is no alternative to the present social order as the social order gets meaner and grimmer and bleaker. And yet I think we need to be able to envision that world that we want, and then to, critically important, convey it in terms that, ordinary people can understand, and to convey the stakes. I don't think we're always that good at it. But we also need to be able to act with passion and humor. And I remember there was a wonderful essay that came in. I asked people on my mailing list if they had wonderful essays to suggest, in addition to the famous names, the Alice Walkers, the Vlachov Havels, the Howard Zinns. And somebody who was just a Boeing worker, or just a person who made airplanes on the assembly line, sent in a piece. His wife was from Zambia, formerly Northern Rhodesia, about the resistance effort that drove the British out, called the Cha-Cha-Cha, which is this largely nonviolent resistance effort. And it's kind of a wonderfully inspiring story. What happened is that if you were black in that culture and you bought something at a white store, you had to have it handed out through the window. It was a very demeaning action. It was a way of maintaining power and authority, basically. And, you know, the sense that you could not be trusted to get something yourself. So somebody, I think he was a fairly prominent community leader, went in and bought a Land Rover and said, well, you know, I want it handed out through the window. And they said, well, don't worry about that. The gate's open. Thank you very much for your business. You're welcome to drive it out. And he said, no, I want the law followed. I want it handed out through the window. And they said, well, sir, I don't think it's going to fit through the window. It's quite a large car. It's quite a small window. In fact, you know, we know this is not going to fit through the window. You can't drive it out through the window. He said, no, I want it driven out. It has to go out through the window. The law has to be obeyed. And he got in the car and he drove it out through the window and the wall. And this launched this uprising called the Cha-Cha-Cha. And at one point, I mean, it just spread all over the country. And they brought in this very stern-jawed British council to put down the uprising. And one of the organizers got the idea of gathering as many of the very largest women to stand and meet him naked on the runway. And so you have to imagine this plane touches down. He looks out and he sees this just sea of very large naked women waving and singing to him to greet him. And he doesn't know what to do. I mean, the answer to this is not in your colonial administrator's rule book. And he just panics, and he asks the pilot to take him back to England, and which they do, and the country gets its freedom a short while afterwards. And I love that story for its audaciousness and the sense of humor, and it strikes me that that's part of what we have to keep us going. And also, if we can, to convey our vision. I mean, how do I describe it? In a culture that's post 9/11, and we're going to be post 9/11 probably for the rest of our lives, there's so much manipulated fear that we don't want to up the ante on it. We don't want to increase it, because it then plays into the hands of those who are running this country with contempt for humans and their lives and for the earth and for everything else. And at the same time, I think we need to find ways to be able to challenge them. And so I think of those two stories, and I can't imagine that either one of them would have in any way upped the ante of fear. When I think of the people marching, I mean, it didn't get Bush out, but marching with a pig nose as for Halliburton during the Republican convention. And you know, somehow we've got to be able to combine that audaciousness and that creativity, at least some of the time, in a way that breaks through the lies and breaks through the kinds of manipulations that we face. And I love those stories as examples of that. I think we also need to be able to savor the journey, and that's really critical. And it's hard in some ways, but I think probably most of us who've been at it a while, that's what we've found ourselves able to do. In an earlier book I wrote, a friend of mine named Hazel Wolf, My Soul of a Citizen book, who died at 101 years old and was one of the more, about I think it was a year ago, one of the more amazing activists I've ever met. Started out as a labor organizer in her 20s. She was part of the movement in Washington State that brought one of the first public pension systems in the entire country that became a model for Social Security. And later she was a secretary for a civil rights lawyer and labor lawyer, so she never made too much money. And she lived off Social Security for 36 years. So something she did in her 20s came back to benefit her, you know, the rest of her life. And then in her 60s, she got involved in Audubon Society and organized Audubon chapters all over the Northwest, and also, because of her labor background, created some of the first labor environmental coalitions probably in the country. And she was just working with them, working with the Native American tribes, I mean, bringing in this wide groups of people. And at one point, my state of Washington had a battle over the Growth Management Act, and the construction industry went to the buildings trades unions and asked with the assumption that they'd get it, that they oppose it. And the buildings trades union said, no, I'm sorry, this is part of what makes our state's economy powerful, is that we take care of our environment. We're going to align ourselves with the environmentalists. And that was part of the work of Hazel Wolf. And so, you know, amazing, amazing woman. And yet, after working literally, you know, a lifetime, she was the most kind of lighthearted and joking and teasing. I remember she was down in Nicaragua during the Central America Wars of the Bush senior administration, and a congressman came up to her and said kind of condescendingly, oh, I hear you're a bird watcher. And she said, oh, yes, there's lots of birds in Washington, D.C. that need watching these days. And it just, you know, it just silenced him. And that kind of spirit, I think, is essential. I mean, she talked about going hiking and kayaking, both of which she did in her 90s, and she says, then gets a mischievous smile, and she says, then you come back ready to take on Exxon. And it was a sense of delight in the work, and it was a delight that drew people to her. I remember her 100th birthday party, they had 600 people packing a hall and 300 more trying to get in and just couldn't, and everybody had been touched by her. And somebody said, yeah, I retired at 65, and she called me up and she said, oh, hey, youngster, you're just getting started. I have a committee for you. I met her when I did my first book 20-something years ago on a nuclear weapons complex, and she'd called me up by the, you know, 3 weeks later to be on a nuclear committee. And somebody else said, I was in 7th grade, and she spoke to my 7th grade class. And I've been an environmentalist ever since for 20 years. And somebody else was the head of the Federation of Native American Tribes, National Federation, and described being the first person in his tribe to go to college. Most didn't even go to high school. And being pulled in, ready at many points to drop out because it was such a harsh environment, except that Hazel Wolf would knock on the door in a little basement apartment and say, you're doing this for your community. You're not just doing this for yourself. You have to keep on. And so I thought about that. You know, this is the definition of a life well spent, is one working and connecting. I mean, there is another ethic in our culture of disconnection. I remember right after 9/11, somebody wrote a letter to my local paper and said, be patriotic, go out to the mall and buy a sofa. And I thought, you know, these are the dreams of our society. Go out to the mall and buy a sofa. And that's true patriotism, because, you know, you'll fuel the consumption society. I think we need to have some other dreams. And so Hazel and people like that embodied that. And think of somebody like Desmond Tutu. And you think about Tutu's for a second and what he's faced, you know, in his life. I mean, he had friends who were imprisoned, tortured, murdered by that apartheid regime. I mean, he himself, you know, even as a bishop, an archbishop, a Nobel Peace Prize winner, still faced degrading situations as a black man in that culture. And when they finally got their freedom, he chaired this Truth and Reconciliation Commission to try and bring forth the stories of really the most horrendous abuses. And the rule was that if you testified fully and comprehensively and named all the people and said exactly what happened, you would get amnesty, but if you didn't, you would be prosecuted for those crimes. And it was a way of taking a divided nation and moving forwards, but not bearing the history the way too many countries, you know, Allende's, not Allende's Chile, but, you know, the post-Pinochet Chile has buried the stories of the Pinochet horrors, and post-Franco Spain has buried the stories of the Franco Spain. And if I go down to the South and ask students there what they learn about segregation in the civil rights movement, they'll say as little as possible. You know, we brush over it. You know, there's a picture of a drinking fountain and a picture of King. I mean, it's not, you can't obliterate it. But we move over it so quickly that we don't really look at, you know, how deeply the institutions of that culture were wedded to it, some of which are the same institutions that have spearheaded Bush's victory this round. And so this was a way of coming to grips with those hard realities. And more recently, he's been obviously speaking out against Bush's war in Iraq, but also was in Rwanda and trying to heal that culture where people are going to have to live with each other after hacking each other apart with machetes. And you take the sum total of everything he's been up against, and you would think that this would be just a grim and downhearted individual. But if you've ever seen Tutu speak, he's delightful. He's laughing, he's joking, he's teasing, he's almost dancing off the stage. It's clear that he thinks that this is a wonderful gift to be here on the earth. And I remember seeing him, it was a benefit in Los Angeles for a South African project, and he's been battling prostate cancer, so he lay down before his talk and then got up and gave it. And then there was a music started playing, a band from East Los Angeles, and people started dancing, and I looked over, and there was Desmond Tutu dancing away right in the middle of the dance floor. And I thought, I've never seen a Nobel Peace Prize winner dance before, much less an archbishop. And the lesson is that this is somebody who savors life to the fullest. And if there's music, as long as he's able to, he is going to be dancing. And if there's food, good food, he'll be eating it, and good conversation, he'll be part of it, and jokes, and his favorite phrase is, God is a sense of humor. I've heard him three times, every time he uses it to tell some kind of story, just reflecting on just how we are as human creatures, and this, how absurd our lives are, and yet he says it with this love and passion that just clear, he is delighted to be here on this earth. And that embrace of what I would call the gifts of this world, and he would call, from his tradition, the grace of this world, that's absolutely intertwined with his radical prophetic voice. You can't separate them. And so it strikes me that there's a powerful model for all of us as we go forward, and not only go forward, but more importantly, as we try and bring others with us, particularly those who've just come in and now feel downhearted and despairing. And that is to recognize that this is life's work, and that we may not see everything, all the fruits of our actions. I remember going to the house of Susan B. Anthony, now a museum in Rochester, New York, and just noticing that it was a dozen years after her death that women got the vote. And you could look back on that life of hers and say it was wasted, but obviously we don't, because we have the hindsight of history. And yet at the time, what you had to do, which is what she did and so many others, is look forward over the horizon. And that has to be our challenge, to see that future where human beings get treated with decency, where we treat the planet with respect, where we recognize that we're part of a global community and not its rulers and masters. And it may take a while. I actually draw the book's title from a Billie Holiday phrase, as a song, where she said, the difficult we do at once, the impossible, will take a little while. And bringing in that future of justice may take a little while. But it still is something that we have the power to create. And we can pass on that struggle to other generations. And as we do that, part of what we're doing is we're talking about the immediate issues, of course. And they're real and they're urgent. Part of it is figuring out ways to act with strength and power that reach out beyond the bounds of our current movements. And part of it is recognizing why we're here on the earth, and that is to work for justice. Thanks very much.
right now? Is there an organization? Is there suggestions?
Well, I think the challenge is very, the political challenge, you know, is really twofold. Obviously, some horrendous moves are going to be initiated by this administration. They're going to try and shred what's left of our social safety net, what they haven't succeeded in shredding already. They're going to continue to absolutely make regressive moves with taxes. They're going to look to invade other countries. They're going to pillage the environment. I mean, all of those things. And so what we have to do is to be able to be a force that resists that and in part galvanize. And this is hard. I mean, many of these things can still be blocked by filibusters in the Senate, at least those that involve legislation. And we've got to put enough pressure on to be able to say, excuse me, not all of America voted for these folks, and these policies are disastrous morally and every other way. And we have to be able to put enough pressure on to make people begin to stand up. I mean, that's an absolutely critical task. I think we also have to, I mean, in the case of some, for instance, something like the war in Iraq, obviously we have to put pressure to get us out of there. I mean, no one else is going to do that except citizen activism. You're certainly not going to have the Republican-dominated Senate and Bush. I mean, at some point, if there is enough pressure, they may declare victory and then get out. But that would be a gift to us as well, if in fact it is our pressure that creates that, not to mention that besieged country. So being able to do that, you know, part of the challenge is, it obviously depends on where people are geographically, who they, you know, who's around to work with them. I mean, the coalitions that came together, the labor, the environmental coalitions, the, you know, civil rights organizations, all those folks who worked on that campaign, they have to stick working together. I mean, we are often too fractured, and, you know, meanwhile the Republicans have a devil's deal of between the religious right that, you know, was just fixated on these couple of issues of abortion and gay marriage and a few others, and the forces of corporate greed that don't give a damn about any of those issues but are only too happy to use those folks as the foot soldiers. So I would argue that there's more possibility of reaching out to those people, say, in those conservative churches than there are to the head of Lockheed Martin or somebody like that. And we have to really raise some of those issues that about what is happening to most people in the country. Because in part, I actually think that is part of what creates that fundamentalist backlash, is this sense of being dislocated and this sense of everything being out of control.
Question is basically the corruption of language. A few comments about that leading more.
Yeah, I remember a while ago, this is during the Central America Wars, I guess it's quite a while ago, I wrote an essay called The Vietnamization of Language, because it was, I can't remember that one of our people who was basically working with some of the death squads and whatever had gotten assassinated. And I said, and they were called, I can't remember, they're describing him as, you know, this innocent victim. And I said, well, you know, you have to mourn any human loss, but let's recognize that this person was engaged in warfare and was a legit, you know, if anyone is a legitimate target, he was a legitimate target. And it was, and I was thinking about the way that language just gets twisted. I mean, you look at something like the Iraq War, and the way in which somebody, here's Sadr, who the person, one of the main people we're struggling with, whose father and brother, and father and uncle, were killed by Saddam Hussein. And somehow, you know, he is a Ba'athist, he's a terrorist. I mean, there's no sense of context to concede that at any point some people might be resisting us for legitimate reasons. That is, they don't want their country dominated by us. And so without romanticizing, I mean, I don't certainly want to excuse or romanticize, you know, something like the, you know, the 9/11 horrors. But even there, you look at, remember Bush's phrase about this is a war of good versus evil. And I remember thinking, the evil is real. I mean, if you call actions evil and reprehensible, those were evil and reprehensible actions. The good was much more mixed, because given how much, you know, our role in creating bin Laden to begin with and nurturing him, calling ourselves the forces of good is a little bit dubious. And so part of the challenge is we have to be able to break through that language of lies, but also talk in language that's compelling and powerful enough that it reaches out, that we're not just talking about dry abstractions. which sometimes we're loath to do.
Question is, other than the internet, do you see any cracks in the corporate control of the media?
Well, it's interesting. I think the internet is the largest crack at the moment. I mean, you look at something like MoveOn, and they're up to 2.5 million people. It's huge. And the number of people who just, where do I get my information? I log on. I mean, it's, you know, select, you know, handful of radio shows, and then I get most of it online. And part of the challenge, I think, is to not, how to describe it, to use that as a base to build from, but then to not give up those public airwaves. I mean, I think that the Sinclair fight was kind of interesting, because here was this company that was going to just put this one-hour infomercial into primetime TV for George Bush. And the organizing that occurred could not have happened without the internet. I mean, without Move On and True Majority and all the rest of those groups. I mean, people could not have responded that quickly, that effectively. But they responded effectively enough that they didn't completely back off, but they backed off significantly and aired, you know, a very different show than what they were intending to do originally. And so part of the challenge, I think, is using that base to contest it. I mean, obviously supporting alternative radio stations and things like that, you know, as ways to draw people together, but also not giving up and holding. I mean, I often call local journalists and say, you know, just very, I'm always very nice and very polite. You know, excuse me, you got this story. You know, there's some piece missing. Here's a source you maybe haven't thought of. Here's a way to approach it that maybe you didn't seem to include in your article. I mean, always, you know, if you come on nice and assume goodwill, I think you get further. At the same time, obviously, we've got to organize around this issue of media concentration. To a certain degree, it does cross lines. I mean, when the FCC was about to, you know, just completely open things up and drop the last bars, it wasn't just people from the political left who were angry at that. I mean, there was a fair amount of people on the political right as well. And though, you know, that's part of making common cause and alliance with some of those folks. You know, I mean, I have to say that when the fundamentalists call it hellavision, I tend to agree.
Okay, right back here. If the right has suggested so forcefully that we can't believe the exit polling in terms of choice of candidate, how then can we believe the exit polling in terms of moral values being the top issue in the election?
Well, I don't think that the right has suggested that you can't, that the exit polling in terms of choice of candidate.
Certainly said so in terms of Ohio and in Florida, where Kerry was suggesting.
Oh, I see what you're saying. You're saying they're saying the exit polls are wrong. I think that, I mean, I've looked a lot, as the information comes out, my own feeling is that there is something very possibly awry with the results of that election, because those exit polls, you know, are time and time again are inordinately precise, and so there's some kind of huge gap that's thinner, that at this point is unexplained, and that's a serious issue. I mean, we, at the very very least, we have to do a major push to say, don't allow them to pass anything until they guarantee a paper trail for future elections, because nothing is safe, nothing is secure, and if democracy, I mean, we have the stories of, you know, 4,000 votes being added, you know, 3,000 melting away. I mean, we've got these stories. There's probably more beneath the surface. More is being unveiled, and I'm not convinced that, how to describe it, I think that Bush's lies and manipulations may well have won the election, combined with all the structural things like felon disenfranchisement and all the rest. I don't necessarily think that they won it only by stealing the votes. We don't know that, but we need to find out everything that's happened, but I don't think we should assume that it is impossible for him to have won. I won't say cleanly, because none of the campaign was clean, and, you know, the voter intimidation and all the rest of it, and the discarding of Democratic registrations and the re-registering of students who signed medical marijuana petitions so that they can't vote. I had known about it in Florida. Turns out it went on in Pennsylvania as well, maybe some other states. I mean, all that is tremendously ugly, has to be raised as a real issue. I mean, that said, I think when those polls did say that this is what people were voting on, I do give them some validity. I mean, the polls that were released and the final numbers were adjusted to the vote, which is not something that is a particular conspiracy of this election. It is standard operating procedure. But what it meant is when you looked at them, they said, oh, it accords with the numbers, everything is fine. But the way the breakdowns, I think, are essentially valid, and I think they're ones that we have to learn from, that says, you know, whether it's 22% or 19% or whatever it happens to be, there is a significant body of people who are responding in a certain way, and I think we need to think about that as a way of moving forward.
Okay. Question is, what can you say to those who aren't paying attention?
Well, it's interesting. I was at a friend of mine was talking the other day, and they're describing their boss doing some pretty destructive things, and she said, "It's a nice person, it's a good person, but she just kind of gets distracted a lot." And I thought, what a metaphor for America. You know, we're good people. We just get distracted a lot. And I think that that's, I remember a while ago Neil Postman said, it was a book he called Amusing Ourselves to Death. And I think part of what we have is this culture of distraction. And why is it that a majority of people who voted for George Bush, believed that there was this connection between Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda, this active connection, and that there were really weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. I mean, why did they, you know, and that the rest of the world, I mean, talk about things that are, you know, unarguable, that the rest of the world I thought was backing us instead of opposing us. Well, it's from that culture of distraction. I mean, it's from outright lies, but it's also that distraction. And part of the challenge, I think, is, I mean, among the issues we have to take on are the issues of time overload. Of people being so harried in their workplaces that they barely can flip on the TV for a minute after they get home and don't have time to think about what's actually going on. And somehow the challenge, I mean, I see, you know, there's all the splits in the country, the red states and the blue states and all that stuff, but I see the split between people who are in some ways connected to some context that gives them the chance to actually think critically about what's going on, like those union people I mentioned in, you know, Michigan, and those who aren't, and who are just at the mercy of the TV and the radio and the rest of that culture of lies that just, on the one hand, completely distracts us with, you know, Brittany and Janet Jackson's boob and, you know, all just stupid stuff. And then the other hand, you know, feeds us the lies. And I think the two fit together and build on each other.
Would it be a better idea to have campaigns that are a much shorter election cycle?
Well, I think that the campaigns, I mean, part of the challenge for us is how do we use the territory between the election cycles to start changing the dialogue in the country? I mean, that's the, you know, the campaign process, I think, is inevitably going to be corrupted by its nature. And we can try and change that. I mean, certainly things like these powerful clean elections models that occur in Vermont and Arizona and Maine, where for $5 contributions, you get to run without ever having to take money from a lobbyist or, you know, special interest. I mean, that's very, very powerful. I mean, there's lots of technical things we can do. But I also think that a lot of what happens is the period in between the campaigns. I mean, that's our chance to shift the culture around. I mean, I think that the supporters of Bush are more likely to be able to listen to us now than they were before the election, on the eve of the election, because they were locked into, I'm going to vote for Bush. And now we can begin a dialogue anew that says, okay, I know you voted for Bush. What do you think of what we're doing in Iraq, really? And, you know, the fact that there isn't a way out, and that that as long as we're there, we're going to be seen as colonial occupiers, or whatever it happens to be. But I think we can begin the conversations. I'm absolutely not an expert, but one of the things that I think is a real issue is the ability of administrations like Bush's to run up the debt in part depends on other countries being willing to continue to buy it. Uh-huh. You know, and so the question is not will they come in and take over, but will they call in what happens if they call in loans and just, you know, and decide that essentially the United States is no longer a good investment, they're no longer going to keep rolling it up, or they're sort of not going to do it except for an exorbitant rate of interest. And I think that there is, you know, the distinct possibility in a circumstance like this, you know, of a serious economic crash. Now, on the one hand, if that happens in the next few years, I'm glad it'll happen on Bush's watch. On the other hand, there's a hell of a lot of human misery. And this is a kind of paradox in general that I think we face, where, you know, if we're going to be honest, we're watching that war, you know, do we want it to go stunningly well? Well, not really. But for it not to go stunningly well, it means some innocent 18-year-old or 20-year-old or 23-year-old is going to die. Now, I mean, leave aside the Iraqis, but I'm just talking about, you know, our soldiers that, you know, and I think that I've revolved around that dilemma a couple of times. Like, you know, am I rooting for disaster? I mean, you know, because you get accused by the right of that. And what I've realized is no, because that stuff is out of our control anyway. We, you know, we can't control what occurs, but we can point out why it is occurring and what alternatives could be occurring. And that's really our task.
Thank you so very much. You have a wonderful way of giving hope and issuing us challenges.